Welcome to the Charlotte Readers Podcast, where books and writing topics are center stage and where authors give voice to the written words. I'm Landis Wade, and on behalf of my co-host, Hannah LaRue and Sarah Archer, we thank you for listening.
The Charlotte Readers Podcast is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Listen to your city at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Hey listeners, this is Sarah Archer. Before we get started with today's show, I have a quick word. Charlotte Readers Podcast now has podcast books. It's true, we have two kinds, fiction and nonfiction. Our fiction book is titled Death by Podcasting, co-written by Landis and me. It's a comedic mystery where we make fun of podcasters and writers in the vein of Only Murders in the Building. It was a lot of fun to write, and it's available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. We also have 8 nonfiction quote books created from over 500 podcast interviews. The Write Quote series is a collection of inspirational and practical quotes about writing, publishing, and book marketing from the first 4 years of the podcast. The books come with forewords and reflections by Hannah, Landis, and me. They're available in paperback and ebook, and here's a bonus. The first ebook in the series, about the writing life, can be downloaded for free. You can find links for all 9 books at the podcast books page of charlottereaderspodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and if you read our books, thanks for reading. Now let's get on with the show.
Hey guys, we are back for another episode of Charlotte Readers Podcast. We're at episode 382 today, and I'm super excited about our guest. We have award-winning author Joe Clifford with us. I was just telling him before we hopped on the call, I basically started the interview with a recording because I was like, this is such a great book. I can already tell this is going to be a fun conversation. His book that we're going to be talking about today is All Who Wander. His books have been praised, super widely, really great reviews across the board. E.A. Amen calls his latest gritty, compelling, and fearless a powerful read. And today we're going to talk a little bit about his background and the book and its themes and all of that good stuff. But first, welcome to the show, Joe. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Looking forward to this.
Yeah. So you're coming to us from San Francisco, right? Is that where you are right now?
The Bay Area. Yeah. East Bay Hills.
Okay, cool.
It's rainy and drizzly and sort of, it's like the Nightmare on Elm Street all day long, which is good for writing mysteries. It's a nice, but now the fog doesn't clear until 1 and then it comes back in about 4. So you get about 3 hours of sunshine, but works.
It sounds perfect for a writer to me.
Yeah, yeah. I actually got my grad degree and my grad school degree down in Miami, and it's so hard to be depressed in Miami because it's always sunny and people are happy, and it's like, I need some darkness to write this stuff.
Is that what brought you back to San Francisco? So you were just like, it's too sunny here. I'm a dark guy.
I'm so not a Miami person. Nostalgia brought me back. I moved here in 92 or 91. Or 90, yeah, I'm getting old. But I had read, it was two things that brought me west. One was Jack Kerouac, for whom my second son, Jackson Kerouac, is named after. I'm not supposed to mention his name on air. I realized my wife told me, so maybe edit that out. I don't know. I don't listen to my, I should listen to my wife more. She's much smarter than I am. But I read Kerouac, and I really embody just about every all-American sort of screw-up cliche. I love the Yankees. I love Catcher in the Rye. My other son's named Holden, once again violating the rule. And then of course I came out here to be a rock star, rock and roll star. And within a year I went from, never having had a beer, I grew up super Christian, to being addicted to meth and heroin in about a year's time. So, moderation, temperance. I know forbidding, that doesn't banning just doesn't work, at least, for me. Mm-hmm. So being a father, it's interesting because, my son, when Holden, again, with, I'm just naming the kids. We're all okay. In at this point. When he turned 7 or whenever he got old enough to read, I went in to go check on him in his room, and he had a copy of my book, Junkie Love, with the big syringe on the cover on his chest. That was the first book he wanted to read, was his dad's book. Yeah, you fell asleep on like page one, which hopefully you didn't absorb too much because it's a pretty harrowing read. But I just thought it was adorable. Like you know, that's the first thing he wanted to read, took it off the shelf and was like, all right.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, and I think it's really cool, too, that you were just even so, it sounds like you're pretty open about that part of your story as well, especially having written that book, which I'm excited to read that for sure. And your kids, you know, that's, how old was your son when that happened, when you walked in and he had that on his chest?
I mean, he was, whenever he could read, I mean, he had just learned to read. And okay. I mean, the hard thing is that, you know, my life quite literally is an open book. I mean, you can put my name in a search engine and the first thing you see is, you know, Joe Clifford, recovering drug addict. And I know my sons showed his, you know, his friends at school, my Wikipedia page, and the first thing is Joe Clifford's an author, you know, recovering drug addict. I'm not even sure which comes first. I think the addict angle might always, you know, it's hard to get away from that. It's both the blessing, you know, being removed from it now, and kind of a curse. I feel a little bit like Rick Springfield playing a concert, and I'm like, you know what? I don't feel like playing Jesse's Girl tonight. And like, if you're Rick Springfield, you're not. That's my Pomeranian. I had door closed with a pot. She just kicked it open, and you'll see her fucking across.
She wanted
the screen
to be. It's okay. We all three of us hosts have dogs, yes, and we're always like, might pop in. You never know. So welcome.
Yeah. Well, there she is. We just gotta hope she doesn't bark, which is will be tough. No. You know, the drug thing. I get kind of. You know, I had to go back to my old high school. I didn't have to go back. They paid me to go back. So I flew back to give a talk to my high school. You know, it was the senior class, and I'm going, you know, I'm talking to these kids aren't stupid. They're 16 years old. They're 17 years old, you know, as the juniors and seniors, 18 years old. And I'm up there telling them not to do drugs. But at the same time, I'm like, yeah, but I'm here because I did drugs. You know, like, so what I'm really saying is do drugs, but stop while your brain is still mostly functioning. And then you bounce back, write about it, and you get a career, because that's sort of how it happened, which is maybe just a pessimistic way of looking at it, or overanalyzing the number of years I've talked about Junkie Love, because it's a book and a past I can't escape. And sometimes you want to be like, you know, hey, I've written, you know, 24 other books. I mean, we're talking about All Who Wander, but we'll end up talking mostly about, you know, that time, because it's what shapes the writing. All of everything I experienced in, you know, during those, the salad years, we'll call them, you know, makes it into the book. All my books deal with addiction. They all deal with, you know, themes of mental illness. They all deal with that darkness. And that's when I came of age. And it was sort of a harrowing, not sort of, it was a harrowing experience. I mean, it's PTSD, and not in the sense of like, you know, on par with like soldiers or heroes or, you know, first responders. It just in the sense that, like, you know, every day you live thinking you were going to die. Me and my friend Tom Pitts and I, he's another crime author, and I'm contractually obligated to mention his name during every interview. But we used to be running partners, you know, and junkies together. And then here it is, you know, 20, 25 years later, we're both, you know, published authors and dads, and you know, we maintain a friendship, and obviously we're both, you know, off the stuff, because there's no stories of, you know, junkies going, yeah, you know, I just figured a way to incorporate it and make it work for me. And, you know, I mean, the story only ends one of three ways: jails, institutions, and death. And that's not because I do AA. I despise AA, but I love their bumper stickers. They're fantastic. Their slogans are great.
There you go.
And it's true. You end up, it's jails, institutions, or death. That's your only option. There's no, you don't find a way to live with heroin addiction, especially. I mean, any addiction. I mean, you know, it's, you know, heroin's a daily thing. Like, if you don't take it, your body doesn't function. So it's not a matter of waking up and going, you know, hey, I'd like to get high today and have some fun. Like, it's your medicine. You know, if you don't get it, you're not able to move.
It's really interesting. You know, I'm kind of curious, and something that I've always been really interested in, you know, there's this whole concept of creativity and being under the influence of something, you know, like grab your bourbon and get into a like den and begin writing, or like,
no, it's romantic. And that's sort of what sucked me in. I've been watching this clip from Ed Harris in the movie Kodachrome. And it's just, if you can find it, it's just a fantastic quote. And he's just talking about like happiness is the great lie of all you know, the great lie of the, you know, the late 20th century. And he goes, Hemingway, Hendrix, they were all miserable shits. You know, no art has ever come from a place of happiness. Every artist, you know, sex, rage, anger, it's a hole that can never be filled. It's just a great quote. And it's sad because I think there's something to the creative process that, you know, any artist exchanges a mental wellness for the ability to create. It's sort of like, you know, just an exchange you make, and you trade a piece of your sanity to create. And I don't know really any artist, and I know quite a few, who isn't a little damaged in some way. Mm-hmm. There's, once again, the cliche, it's a meme, but you can see it, like, you know, every author's story, you know, that you get the tragic backstory, the, you know, the problems with substances, the coming, you know, like, it's a fairly commonly, you know, traversed path. But I'm not sure, you know, about the, you know, I mean, you can definitely create work on our, you know, definitely create great work on drugs, but you far better work off drugs. I mean, you think you're creating better work on drugs.
Yeah.
But no, it's just, it's all consuming and it sucks you up. And having the perspective of living like that, I lacked empathy and I lacked compassion. I grew up very Christian, very right wing, very, I live in a small town and we look the same. We all talk the same. And it's very easy to look at the world that way and go, well, you know, police brutality, stop breaking the law. I just didn't see a world where people weren't like me. So I needed that experience. You know, if we're getting to, you know, it's California, you get to the whole vibe thing or whatever, but you know, that was part of my quote unquote journey. And God, I hate myself for using that. But you know, I needed to be humbled, and it's very hard to feel superior when you're sleeping under a bridge and eating food out of a dumpster. You sort of lose that, you know, like, okay, all right. And then you see all the, and I think the weird thing is that you meet people, and this is something I could never have understood, because empathy can't be taught. It has to be experienced, right? We can be taught sympathy, but empathy, you have to learn it. And you'll meet people out there who are parents, and they're good parents, and they love their kids just as much as I love mine. They also happen to be drug addicts. And you explain that to the average person, they're like, well, take those kids away from that. But like, I've spent time with them. They love their children the same way we love our children, you know? And the drug part's unfortunate. The criminality part's unfortunate, but it doesn't change that's still a kid that looks at his dad or, you know, looks at his mom and with the same love and appreciation our kids have. Mm-hmm. Like, that's still their source of security. And they weren't bad people. These weren't all like, you know, you watch a TV show and you got the drug pusher and he's cackling, he's rubbing his hands together and he has no ethics or morals. But some of the nicest, most decent people I met were the people who were dealing me drugs. Gluehead, you know, who got his name, ironically, from a bad haircut as a kid. And they named him, got Gluehead, which sort of destines you to be a drug dealer, right? But he doesn't mind talking about this stuff. He's signed off so I could put him in Chunky Love. He's he's but one of the sweetest, nicest, most big-hearted people I've ever met in my life. And when I was at my lowest and needed a friend, like, Gluehead was it. Like, he, you know, would put his arm around me and tell me it'd be okay. He's not like the drug dealers in the movies. And it's not the way it's depicted. And so when I was, you know, I set out to write Junkie Love, I had one goal, and that was that I wanted to tell the story of what addiction was really like. And not sugarcoat it or not glamorize it, make these people into, you know, some kind of demons. It's just like regular life. You meet some good people, you meet some bad people, you meet all different people. Everyone's fighting their own battle, but these people are your friends, at least while you're there. And then there's people who aren't your friends. There's people there who are there just to screw you over. But like I said, Tom Pitts and I are still friends to this day. And my best friends are the people who I went through that with during the 90s, and we survived. And, you know, and every year we get together, some of us, for the World of Concrete Conference in Las Vegas. There's a plug for World of Concrete, your number one concrete. But that's true. It's all my friends from back in the day, and we've all sort of stopped doing that stuff. And one of them, well, they were never as bad as I was, but one of the guys owns a construction company, and every year now we gather for like a reunion in Las Vegas for the World of Concrete, which is pretty funny. But yeah, it's like a college reunion, and these are all characters in Junkie Love, and it's amazing that I still know them. It's amazing that we survived. Some of us, you know, took a harder road than others, but you know, we're still here, and, mm-hmm. and yeah, it's a bond that's hard to break.
Yeah, and I think it's really kind of evident in your writing too that, you know, kind of going back to the whole idea of like being under the influence of something can lead to creativity. And I think maybe necessarily, like, sure, you think when you're high or drunk or on something that your ideas are really good, but it's really kind of what comes after that period in your life. You can kind of put the concepts together or the things that you've learned. And I think, again, you know, kind of going into All Who Wander, you know, and I can't wait to read Junkie Love. I'm definitely going to do that, especially after hearing you talk right now. But... But you know, no,
just let me know if you get past chapter 11. And here, I'll tell you, chapter 11, this is another multi-layered joke that uh-huh. nobody gets. So I'll just tell you beforehand. But chapter 11 is the low point of the book. And chapter 11, because bankruptcy, morally bankrupt. Nobody got that joke that I put in chapter 11. So I'll just tell you that I found it hysterical. But I think part of the reason Junkie Love resonated or works well, or I wrote that book when I was... I mean, just barely, like 2 months, 3 months sober, I wrote a draft mm-hmm. of that. And it was an incomprehensible draft. It was a draft that, you know, centered around these tiny monkeys the size of, you know, field mice trying to kill God and all this science fiction stuff. And it was all this weird, just horrible, horrible writing. And in between, I would sprinkle these little vignettes about what it was like living on the street and being a drug addict. And when I got, you know, my shit together, and I went back and looked at the book, and I went, you know, got my degree, and I learned how to write from, you know, people like Lynn Barrett and Les Standiford and John Dufresne down at FIU, where Dennis Lehane got his master's degree. And I went back and looked at the book. I realized all that goofy shit with the little monkeys and whatever, it was just my way of avoiding talking about the really hard stuff. The mm-hmm. the fact that I broke my mother's heart, the fact that I was the first person to inject my brother with drugs, and he died 4 or 5 years ago. Like, I mean, that's something that, and that's not like, oh my God, you know, I'm carrying on this extra guilt. Mm-hmm. I carried the appropriate amount of guilt. I mean, I fucked up. Mm-hmm. I fucked up and I bounced back, and a lot of people didn't bounce back. So anyways, I want to go back and I want to tell that story, and I want to tell that story warts and all. I didn't want to lie about who I was or make a joke out of anything. So I got rid of all that goofy stuff, and I just mm-hmm. left in the hardcore story about the drugs and that trip, and then I learned how to tell a narrative by going and learning, you know, getting a degree in this, and I tell the story in a nonlinear fashion, but it retains some of that raw early urgency of when I first wrote it, because there's a desperation that I can't ever get again. I don't want to get it again, but it did. It was a unique time to write a book and fuse those two elements together, that sort of raw, visceral, pure, you know, in the moment stuff with the polished veneer of an author who's learned his craft. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what made the book, you know, 'cause that's certainly the book that's, you know, does the best for me. It's the book that sells the best. I make more money off the audio version of Junkie Love than I make from all 20 other books combined in all formats. there's something about that book. I get letters resonates. All the time. Mm-hmm. Well, I get letters all the time, like emails, and they're heartbreaking, because I mean, I get two people email me. One is ex-prisoners, ex-cons, and they say, "Hey man, I found your book in prison, and there was one copy, and we passed it all around, and thanks, dude." And those are great. Those are just great. I love it. I mean, I love ex-cons. I love prisoner. I mean, I'm a criminal at heart. I just was a bad criminal. I was too stupid. I got caught. But I love ex-cons, and I desperately want to find a way to supply my, you know, Junkie Love in prison libraries. And if anybody listening could tell me how to do that, I would be thrilled. I reached out to Danny Trejo's agent. She was like, you figure it out. But the other people that write me are parents or sisters or moms and or brothers or girlfriends. And they have an addict in the family. And if we're lucky, the addict is still alive and they say they're reading Junkie Love or they read Junkie Love and it's helping them understand the process. And if it's sadder than that, if it's the, mm-hmm. you know, somebody's passed away, I often get letters saying, thank you. It helped me understand what my son or daughter or brother or sister was thinking, in a way it's the least I can do because the second chance I was given, I went to rehab 18 times. I wasn't given just a second chance, and people in the recovery community carried me across the finish line. It's a debt I can never pay back, and it's not survivor's guilt so much as just the reality of looking at your mm-hmm. life and going, yeah, I mean, I left some carnage behind, and I made it out, and a lot of people didn't. And so Junkie Love was my way of celebrating them and honoring them and telling their story as well as mine and trying to offer hope and you know, get something good out of something bad.
Yeah, I think that's really beautiful. And again, you know, you can really tell that you took a lot away from that period, especially in terms of just like exploring the human brain and how we kind of carry trauma and how we sort of separate ourselves sometimes depending on what's happened in our lives. So I want to kind of jump into talking about this book, All Who Wander. Okay. Like I said, so good. You know, this was such a great story. And it's dark, but I kind of walked away from reading this just feeling very thoughtful and pensive, all of the things like that. Can you give us kind of your thumbnail summary of this story and maybe kind of what inspired you to write this specific book?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote this story and I wrote two books at the same time. I often write two books at the same time. I wrote Lamentation and Skunk Train way back when. And this time I wrote Say My Name and All Who Wander basically at the same time. Say My Name was a little easier because it was first person. I think it's just a more natural voice for me. But this was based on the real life disappearance of a woman whose name I'm now forgetting, Maura Murray, I believe. And I read about it, and it was she just vanished one night, which is often how mystery writers will get their plots. We look at the headlines and fill in the dots. Nobody knows what happened to her. It was just a story, and not just a story. It was a terrible story. It was a woman who went missing, and you know, from the the snow one night, and nobody ever heard from her again. And from there, you know, everything else is mine. I start imagining, you know, reimagining characters who would fit that. What would happen, you know, to a woman that would lead her to flee in the middle of the night in a snowstorm. And then you start getting the backstory. And what interested me most about this was, well, you know, it's a two-person point of view. There's the first-person point of view of Robert and Bobby, who was her, Brooke, the missing girl's estranged brother. And he came into her life at a weird time. He was her half-brother. The mom left, the father didn't really know the daughter. There's a lot of dysfunction, and Bobby and Brooke didn't get along particularly well. They only knew each other for a very short span. And later on, Robert, he's a professor, and a young lady comes into his office saying, I'm Brooke's daughter. And that's, you know, that's sort of where I went with it. I was like, okay, well, how would this all unfold? So, and then I create a mystery, and I love plot. I used to hate it, but Lynn Barrett, who is hands down the smartest human being I've ever met, is a master plot, and she taught me plot, and I just, you know, it really changed my writing. You're able to get much more, you know, multi-layered stuff, but it also demands more of the reader to pick up on it. And when we first started talking, you were talking about the multiple layers, and I was thanking you because I think sometimes, you know, as an author, you know, we spend so much time in our heads. This is, again, I'm quoting Lynn Barrett, but you know, what's fascinating to us is the internal process. Mm-hmm. But people don't read for that. They read for the story. They read for, you know, the action. And that other part, the internal stuff, you can get in there, but you can't do it at the expense of telling a compelling story where people turn the page. And my job is the same as every author, and that's to keep you from going to sleep at night. My job is that when the chapter ends, you can't put the book down. You have to keep reading, and you're going to be tired for work tomorrow and cursing me, because that's what we want. I mean, when I read Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn, which is, you know, to me, one of the greatest works of literature ever, what made that book so freaking brilliant was how she would take Amy and Nick, and at the end of every chapter, you'd read Amy, Nick's chapter, and you'd be like, I got to skip this Amy thing, because that cliffhanger is so great. And then you read Amy, because you got to read in order, and then you're like, I got to skip the Nick part. This Amy part's amazing. And the whole book is like that. You'll also notice that she has not written a book since. I imagine if I wrote a book of that significance, I'm not sure I'd write again, because writing is sort of painful, you know, and she really just nailed it. I am terrified of meeting Gillian Flynn. This is a little bit of an non sequitur, so just hang with me here. There is a payoff. But when I was in high school, me and my friend Jimmy, he had a potbelly pig, and the potbelly pig, God, this is horrible, but we'd have parties, and if you yelled, it would pass out. It would just instantly faint, because it just got overwhelmed. Very, very, and I'm terrified of going to a conference and running into Gillian Flynn, because I have a feeling, if I were to talk to her, much like the pot-bellied pig, I'd just pass out. I mean, I'm so enamored by that, by her and her book, I don't think I could handle it. And so I keep flashing back on that little pot-bellied pig and thinking, like, there I would be in the middle of, you know, the Westin resort or wherever the conference is, and I'm on the floor, and people are like, what happened? And they're like, well, Gillian Flynn went to give him a hug or say hello, and he just passed out.
He just passed out. I would be the same way, though. You know, that it's funny you bring up that book. It's like, in terms of mysteries and psychological thrillers, I mean, it's, you know, it's the best of the best. I still like remember the first line of that second half of that book where Amy is like, I'm so much happier now that I'm dead, you know, that very that's the first line. And you know, I always will remember that, and that's rare, you know, for to read, especially there's so many fast-paced mysteries, right, that kind of just skip over some of the more, you know, the layers like we were talking about.
Yeah.
It really is just kind of like quick, fast pace, let's go to the next page. It doesn't really talk about the inner psyche of people sometimes, and I think with that book was one of the first that I'd ever read where it was like, oh my god.
And it's so pop culture. It's the pop culture. It's so relevant. The cool girl speech. But I think the book doesn't. The book start with Nick talking about the shape of her head. It's amazing. I'm enamored. It's most books I read, and being just the ego, you go, I could do this. I could do this. You know, like, that's a book that's just beyond my skill level. That's the pinnacle, the peak.
Well, this book though is really, really great too. And one of my favorite parts, I definitely wanted to make sure we talked a little bit about this, you know, for our listeners, who we have a great group of mystery readers. And I think for me, my favorite part was just sort of the idea. So we have Bobby/Robert, who is the same person, you know, we kind of start out, and that's Brooke's little half brother, like you were saying, kind of entered into the picture for her at a weird time. And so we kind of, in part of the book, you know, we're seeing him as a kid, as a little kid, and their relationship is strained for sure. And then, you know, we kind of jump forward into the present time, and he is sort of like a well-respected professor, or he's very in the community. He's got like a lot of folks who really look up to him, and his life is really different than you would have thought looking at him as like a child. And he's been through some things too. So it's kind of just like these, they're two different people merged together, kind of, right? So how did you develop him as a character?
Well, I did a lot of drugs in the 90s, and then I became a different person.
There you go.
It explores the duality, and you can't keep writing this. I mean, the reason I stopped the series, and one of the reasons I probably can't, you know, I can't write the same book 17 times. I have no interest in writing the same book 17 times. When I was writing for, you know, my Porter series for Ocean View, lovely people, but they wanted this same book over and over again. You know, with just, you have your PI, I have no interest in that. Like, what interests me are the wounded, the broken, the damaged. And you know, having something, you know, that plagues you from your past, which we've talked about, you know, and haunts you and keeps you up at night, you know, is the impetus for Robert Bobby, you know. So yeah, he's very much split in two, and there's an event that he doesn't know if he's guilty of. That's not giving up too much away. He doesn't, honestly doesn't know. And there's a part of him that fears he's really a bad person, and there's a part of him that believes he's a good person, a good father, a good husband. I think that anybody, when you really, you know, this comes from my friend who got caught for bank robbery after, he's in Junkie Love, and he got caught for bank robbery after the fact, but he had a line once, and he said, every man is secretly George Costanza, which I love. like it's you know, Peter Melman, who wrote for Seinfeld, is a good friend of mine, and it's a great character, because if you watch and you Seinfeld, George is filled with such anxiety and self-doubt, but yet at the same time optimism and hope, and he really is. If you get every man down to his core, like we are all secretly George Costanza, you know. So that's really kind of Robert and Bobby. He's not nearly as funny as George Costanza, but he is emotionally fraught. He's emotionally fragile, and you're getting to that core. And as these events in the book unfold and people from Brooke's past come into his life, and he's remembering what was done to him, what he did to others. If you've ever seen the movie Welcome to the Dollhouse, it's a, you know, brilliant expose of how we pass on abuse. It's something we do. You know, the bully at high school, you'll often find, like John Bender in Breakfast Club, is getting, you know, the cigars put out on his arm, right? Like, you know, we pass on abuse. We learn these traits. And before we were emotionally able to develop coping mechanisms, we unfortunately do harm to others. That's not to excuse, you know, bullies. I know we're very down on bully behavior. Down with bully, that they're bad people. No, but bullies, you know, they're coming from a place generally, you know, without a lot of love. When there's not a lot of love in a house, that's how I grew up, and it's certainly how Brooke and Bobby grew up. When there's not a lot of love in the house, you fight for what scraps there are, and it makes a sibling relationship very difficult. My brother and I, my brother who passed, Josh, we didn't get along growing up because we were fighting for those scraps of love. You know, we had emotionally, physically, just a, you know, a father who was rough. He had his good qualities too. But you know, and a mom, and she, you know, they married when they were 16 and 19. Like, can you imagine? I got married when I had my first kid when I was 40. My father was a dad when he was like 22. I couldn't, when I was 22, I was, you know, off banging dreams in my arm. Like, yeah, he's so, you know, you get a pass for that, but there's, you know, you're fighting for the scraps of love, and kids need love. They need love. They need security. They need to feel they're okay. And in Bobby's case, you have a mother who, they basically lived on the road. They lived at rest stops. They lived in the back of the car. Bobby lived in the back car when she went to strange men's houses, and he doesn't know what she did in there, but she came back with money, and he can put two and two together. And then she comes back at the end of her life, and she's dying, and she dumps this kid off on her ex-husband's doorstep. Now here's Bobby, who has no coping mechanisms, and he's got a new family who doesn't like him. A stepfather who pays his insurance and pays his bills and loved the ex-wife so much that he's pledged to take care of him, but he doesn't love the kid. And Brooke isn't very nice to him either. She tries to be, but her name for him is Fecto, short for defective, you know, which is like, so she's constantly at this, and she's going, God, I feel terrible about it. But she's like, oh, so he has no ability to deal with anything. And when he's 14 and Brooke disappears, the state takes him. And we sort of gloss over that. But in that, there's a five-year period, kind of like when Heathcliff leaves in Wuthering Heights. And we don't know what happened, but something happened to put him back together and make him the man he is. And he comes back, and he's sort of a, you know, Frankenstein in a way. You know, he's been put together by the state, and having spent a lot of time being in the care of the state, these are all well-meaning people, but you know, you're getting a hodgepodge of ideas and you know, putting a man back together, you know, it's not exactly like putting Legos together, or maybe it is. I don't know. Maybe there is a you know, they have a, you know, there's some kind of guidebook, and you go to school for sociology. Maybe they have a, but it feels very, you know, slapped together. Mm-hmm. They're doing the best they can, but they got people coming in and out of the doors. So Robert, who emerges, you know, Bobby enters and Robert emerges, and he carries the echoes of Bobby and who Bobby used to be, but he also tries very, very hard to keep that part of him suppressed. He's got a psychiatrist, Dr. Amy, who's based on my psychiatrist, Dr. Amy, and every week he talks about it, and he's like, you know, why do I do this? I mean, it's the same reason I, you know, everybody, you know, I want to talk to my psychiatrist in a couple hours, and or my therapist. I can't even remember. I have therapy, psychiatry, but you know, you're talking, rehashing the same things over and over, and you reach the point, like, why even talk about it? Why deal with it? It's just life. Just go on, do the best you can. But these are the struggles I see. These are the struggles mm-hmm. I face. These are the things that fascinate me, and I'm glad they fascinate you. And I can tell you that they don't fascinate a lot of people, because one of the things I love to do, because I'm filled with self-loathing, is go and read my bad reviews on Amazon. And every bad review I get, it's always the same. It's like, this guy is so depressing. And I don't, I mean, we've been laughing most of this time, right? Like, yeah. Yes, I'm a depressing, miserable SMB. I fully admit that. But I like to be entertaining about it. Like, I'm going to try to make...
I don't think you're depressing.
Well, you know, as my wife says, I'm charming in short bursts. But no, I mean, we you know, artists aren't known for our jovial, yeah. We were talking about conferences and, you know, the awkwardness and whatnot. But that's what fascinates me. What fascinates me, and I get the opportunity to interview Russell Banks once, who is just, if you've never read Affliction, you'll see where I get, you know, my whole Jay Porter series, who I ripped off from. But he just had a great line about how his characters are wounded. He loved writing about wounded characters. Mm-hmm. I love that. If you read Affliction, which is, you know, not to undersell my own books, but if you have a choice of reading Affliction or Lamentation, read Affliction. It's by far a better book. It's just, it's amazing. It's amazing. And what he does in that book, and if you're really pressed for time, you can watch the film adaptation with Nick Nolte in hands down his best performance. He is amazing in that. And James Coburn, I think one of his last performances, if not his last, and it is, you know, story of fathers and sons and the cold and just basically affliction we pass on. There's a line in that book that's something like, you know, in those who are cursed to love us, you know, and I'm like, God, I think about that, like the people who come into your life, and I've had wonderful people and, mm-hmm. and you know, I got great, my wife's amazing. But, you know, I think like how hard it must be dealing with the artist mindset, you know?
No, it's probably more fun for her than you think.
No, Gillian. Let's wrap. Let me just bring full circle with Gillian Flynn, because she had I heard an interview with her, and I love this. She said she started acting like Amy Dunn, and she would come downstairs and start taking it out on her husband. And so she had to write a note to herself in her office that's "Leave the darkness behind. When you're done, you have to leave it." And it's very, very hard, especially if you kind of. I think this is like method writing, which I don't even know if it's a thing, but like, you know, the method actors. But any book I'm writing, I become fully immersed in the book. I mean, to the point of, and here's where I will go and sound a little insane, but I wrote in December Boys about Jay Porter having a near catastrophic injury to his saphenous vein. A year later, I have a near catastrophic injury to my saphenous vein. I wrote in Say My Name, he has a cancer scare. Doesn't turn out to be cancer. I just found out 2 days ago that I don't have cancer. We found something on my kidney, and I was worried for a few months. So I write these things, and I become so invested that I am predicting my own future. And I know that sounds nuts, but maybe there's other authors out there who can understand this, that like you are your work. And when you write dark mysteries and you write dark pieces, it's very difficult to separate the art from the artist. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to do, you know, like Barth said, you know, death of the art, death of the author, and then the work's done. But, you know, these things are a part of you. You're kind of, you know, you're taking out part of your soul and you're giving it over. And then you're saying, hope you're entertained. It's 99 cents on Kindle.
I think that's beautiful, though. Okay, I'm going to ask you to give us a reading. Could you set it up for us?
Yeah, I'm going to set it up, and I'm also going to, you know, break a rule, because I probably should be reading from All Who Wander, but the problem with that is it's fiction, and it's so hard to set up a fiction piece and go like, okay, well, so here's hit this, that, and this, that, and listeners, I find it's just hard. So I'm going to read something from Junkie Love, and I'm going to read a passage I've never, ever read before.
Wow, okay.
But it's the right time length, and it just feels like the right sort of piece, because it's a transformation piece, and all you need to know about this is this is when I am on a Greyhound bus traveling cross country. And if you've never experienced hell, withdraw from heroin on a Greyhound bus. It is nothing gets worse, but this is just a moment, where I'm on the bus and I'm reflecting, and it's chapter 18 called The Ride Back East. You wash the desert unfurl, sit, stir, cramped in this too small bus seat, forehead resting against the cool tinted glass. There's a faint humming beneath your feet and inside your head, but you can't make out its source. The fun is over, because time is a fickle bitch, and she always demands you make good on any loan she extends. Equal and opposite reaction is one of the governing precepts of the universe. Everything comes with a price. You don't get to borrow something for nothing, and the time one borrows must be paid back one way or the other. Riding on a 3,000-mile bus ride gives you pause for serious reflection. As the crop mountains of Colorado are softly swallowed by the broad plains of Nebraska, you get to sit back and recall that it wasn't 6 months ago she hiked up her skirt, pulled her panties to the side, and straddled you as you rode along the same stretch of road, fleeing Vermont in a rehab, puffed up by yet another promise of golden California. A 3-mile bus ride is sometimes just the companion you need to ward off the specters of time. So as the gentle hills of Iowa roll into Wisconsin's flatlands, and each mile brings me a step further away from my wife and the insanity of the last 10 years, and delivers me closer toward what I have to believe will be a place that finally provides some relief, I remember Italy and being 19 and speeding along the train track and the faith I had that I would someday turn into the man I knew I could be. When did the world get such a leg up to kick an arrogant asshole into submission? How did I get it all so terribly wrong? I can wonder why I was such a lousy son and rotten big brother, and I can fret over my wife's dementia, and I can lament on the architecture of a city that I will never again see, and this Greyhound bus will hold me hostage for another 2 days, and I think maybe this time I will get it right.
Wow. Oh my gosh, I can't wait to read this. I can feel
it's a laugh riot.
it's hilarious.
There are generally some funny parts there. I mean, you have to have a certain sense of humor, mm-hmm. but there's some, you know. I mean, I get a lot of people like, am I supposed to be laughing at this? I'm like, yeah, I think so. Like, you know, if you don't laugh, you cry.
I feel like we got lucky today in talking about two books with you. So All Who Wander and Junkie Love, which is awesome. I wish we had more time, but I hate that. I wish we had like 3 hours. I told him before we hopped on, I was like, I feel like we could just like hang out together. But I want to close.
That's what I love talking.
I
love talking about this stuff.
But I want to close out by just asking you one last question. So, you know, especially with your kind of experience with drug use and the harrowing experience of writing about trauma and all of these things, what would you tell yourself, you know, maybe newly sober, starting your writing journey, what would you tell that person now?
Write. Don't write. Get a day job. I mean, like, hands down, you're about to waste 20 years of your life on this shit. Turn around and run. No, go find something that pays. The average writer makes like $5,000 a year. It's a horrible profession. When people ask me to give, like, they always like, what advice would you give a young writer? And I'm always like, don't do it. And I'm not trying to be funny. I'm like, seriously, don't do it. But when they say I have to do it, it's something that defines me. I am a writer. It's what I have to do. My condolences. Welcome to the club. You know, welcome to hell. Here's your accordion. Now you're in it. And now your job is to tell the story, tell the whole story, tell the truth, nothing but the truth. And you got to be willing to show the mirror, you know, cast the mirror back on yourself and admit, you know, your flaws and your faults without, you know, beating yourself up. It's a balance and a proportion, and you're telling a story and you got to be entertaining. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the formula to writing, any great writing, is you take the universal and you make it unique, and you take the unique and you make it universal. So you take your experience and you make it so everyone can understand it, and you take the world at large and so you make it, you know, personalized. And that's just what you have to do if you're going to succeed in this field. And then you also got to be very lucky.
A little luck too.
having great publicists like Lisa Daly certainly helps. There we go.
She's great. Shout out to Lisa.
I love her. Yeah, I love her.
Hey, Lisa. Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it, and for being so open and vulnerable about, you know, your whole life, really. So congratulations.
No, I feel like I got an extra therapy session, you know. it was a lot of fun. Anytime. Thanks for plugging All Who Wander and trying to keep me on task. It's a book I'm really proud of. I think it's
great.
It's very, in terms of the writing, I think the most recent books are the best writing I've done. And All Who Wander is the last one to come out. So, and it's doing well. I mean, at least in Australia, I think we just hit number 3 in Australia. So
yeah,
I'm big in Australia.
Like well, yeah, everybody listeners, go get yourself a copy. It's great. We've got 2 books featured today. So you got a lot of reading to do. And thank you so much, Joe, for being on.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Yeah, really appreciate it.
Hey, folks, as we wrap up another episode, we just want to say thank you for listening. We appreciate you being here, and we hope you enjoyed the show. We also hope you'll join our community. To do that, feel free to poke around our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. The best way to stay in touch is to sign up for our twice monthly newsletter, and you can do that via the contact page on the website. We won't spam you. That takes way too much time. We're not going to do that. You can also use our website to read our community blog and show notes, submit an elevator pitch to be played on the show, submit a blog post, give us feedback, submit to be on the show, become a Patreon supporter, and to see what's coming up on the show next, order our podcast books, or listen to previous episodes. So many things, and the best part, it's all free. Until the next episode, this is Hannah LaRue, and on behalf of Sarah Archer and Landis Wade, read on, write on, and rock on.